Good day, good day, and welcome, O denizens of Thunderbird Radio Land, as we wander once again through life's garden. Time now for the Eclectic Lunch, right here on CITR, broadcasting from the picturesque promontory known as Ulksen, a land traditionally shared by the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people, and now home to the Point Grey campus of the University of British Columbia. Tomorrow is November 11th. That's Remembrance Day in Canada. It's the day we pay tribute to all those members of the armed services who sacrificed their lives in war. Remember to buy a poppy and help a veteran. Now, about a decade ago, we recorded a program of readings from Barry Broadfoot's book, Six War Years, an oral history of Canada's experience in World War II. It's regular Canadians telling what the war was like, both at home and overseas. And with what's going on in the world right now, where we could be on the brink of World War III any day now, practically any minute now, we're representing a shortened version of the program that took honorable mention for special programming at the Canadian Campus and Community Radio Awards in 2014. It was made with the permission of the Broadwood Estate and the cooperation of the Union of BC Performers. We hope you enjoy it.
At Home and Overseas, a dramatization of the book Six War Years, 1939 to 1945, by Barry Broadfoot. Adapted for radio by Jason Logan and produced with the kind permission of the Broadfoot Estate. In the early 1970s, Vancouver journalist Barry Broadfoot gathered ordinary Canadian men and women to relate their first-hand experiences in the global conflict against fascism known as the Second World War. Broadfoot invited scores of veterans and others who supported their country as civilian war workers and family members to give their subjective impression of a period when Canada became a major combatant and eventually a member of the United Nations, strongly motivated to preserve world peace. These eyewitness accounts expose the tragic cost of war and retell the personal stories, filled with laughter and tears, of those who fought the battles, raised the children, and built the framework for peace. We present it to you with the wish that we may someday achieve a lasting peace for all humanity.
Can you remember? You're at your graduation, and there's the principal standing up there with the carnation in his buttonhole. And he's saying, the boys in the class of 42, Kelvin High School, Winnipeg, should rush out and sign up. But he's making all sorts of sounds like duty and responsibility and devotion to our cause and stuff like that. Everything except, take the king's shilling, boys, and telling the girls to pass among us handing out white feathers. Not all of us were old enough to tear right down to Smith and Portage and sign up for the army. But in 6 months' time, most of us would be. The army wasn't it anyway. Most fellows would have tried for the Navy first, the safe service, and then the Air Force. Even safer as long as you could stay on the ground. But awfully glamorous if you did make air crew. So mid-September comes along, and there I am. And in an hour, I'm in but good. If you were infantry, which I was, you went across town to the University of Manitoba, where they had a basic training camp. In my class, there were 18 guys, and they'd all got the pep talks. Serve your country. Your country needs you. And all that. But all through the weeks of training out there on the campus, I'd see these guys lounging around with girls on the grass. Just enjoying themselves, spending their old man's money. Guys who had been my best friends, or so I thought. Hell, I guess they were. We're coming in from a 12-mile route march, soaking wet and breaking in new boots and cursing life back to our great-grandfather's time, and here would be a couple of guys I'd grown up with, dressed for tennis, walking across the campus to the courts. I found out later that of those 18, only 3 joined up. The rest went to college or university. Oh, you can see how this rankles. I'm not sure I'm mad because I'm missing out on the girls, the tennis, and living the good life, or if I'm cheesed off because I've been had, that I could have gone to university. I met this one guy out at the campus once. We stopped to talk, and I said, and I remember, "When are you enlisting? To the point, get it?" He said, "Never. If you don't have to, why do it?" Something like that. "Ever feel that somebody might call you yellow?" I asked. "Probably. But anybody who knows me knows I'm not." And he walked away. I had to admit that was true, that he wasn't yellow on the face of it. Then he called back, "Ever feel that somebody might call you a sucker?"
Canadian manhood proudly marches side by side with the free nations of the world. Canadian manhood marches, and young Canadians talk the matter over.
Say, Joe, come here. Did you hear what Churchill said the other day?
No, I was out fishing that afternoon. I didn't get a chance to hear him.
Well, he was talking about Hitler. He was talking about the way the Nazis have got hold of most of Europe, see?
Doesn't sound much like news to me.
Wasn't meant to be news. He was just talking horse sense.
Well, okay, don't be so mysterious about it. What was he saying?
Oh, one of those simple things that you don't think much about unless some guy draws your attention to it. The thing that seemed to stick in my mind was just one phrase. One by one.
One by one?
Yeah.
Well, what does he mean by that?
Well, that's Hitler's plan. Keep every nation out of the war until you're ready. And then take them one at a time, see?
There's nothing very original about that. Everybody knows that's Hitler's game. Why,
Yeah. Wait a minute. Listen to this. If all the countries that Hitler has conquered had known then what we know now and had acted accordingly, he'd never have captured them.
Sure, so what?
Well, so it's time we did a little fact-facing, isn't it? Maybe it's time we get into the war.
But we're in it.
You haven't got my drift, fella. I mean it's time you and me got into the war.
But you mean join the army or something?
Yeah.
Maybe it is. I hadn't thought about it.
No, I hadn't either. But I guess it's time we realize that sooner or later, it's men who are going to win this war. Men as well as machines. What do you think?
Yeah, I guess you're right. I guess we better swing into line.
There's a lot of people done it, fella. And I guess a lot more will have to do it before we're through with this business.
Okay. Let's go to work tomorrow and see what's needed. Let's join the parade.
When the Führer says, "We is the master race, we heil, heil!" Right in the Führer's face, not to love the Führer is a great disgrace, so we heil, heil! Right in the Führer's face. When Herr Goebbels says, "We own the world in space, we heil, heil!" Right in Herr Goebbels' face, when Herr Göring says, "They'll never bomb this place, we heil, heil!" Right in Herr Göring's face. Are we not the Superman? Aryan pure Superman.
Yeah, we is the Superman.
Super duper Superman.
Is this Nazi land so good? Would you leave it if you could?
Yeah, this Nazi land is good. We would leave it if we could.
We bring the world new order. Heil Hitler's world new order.
Everyone of foreign race will love the pure space when we bring to the world disorder.
When the pure says, "We is the master race, we heil, heil!" Right in the Führer's face, not to love the Führer is a great disgrace, so we heil, heil!
Right in the Führer's face!
There was this fellow from Kenora, and his name was Alan. I can't remember whether Alan was his first name or his last name, but it didn't matter. What mattered was he was the best damn soldier I've ever seen. And this was before he even got into the fighting. He was 25 or so and had worked for the railroad, and when we were going through Kenora on our way overseas, his wife was at the station. And how she found out, I don't know, but he got word to her somehow. It was only a 5-minute stop, I think, and she had their 3 little girls with her, and they all clung close to each other, the 5 of them. And the rest of us sort of hung back and just looked away. A lot of fellows weren't feeling too happy. It was what you'd call a sad little scene. A lot different than saying goodbye in your house on the last day and then going back to camp. This was it, going overseas. This was when you got down to the nuts and bolts of it. Now, the train gave a hoot, you know, some blasts, and our officers were yelling at us to climb aboard, and we did. And Alan did. And he's crying. And suddenly, a guy named Johnson climbs out. Now, this Johnson is a real bastard. Things I could tell you about him. Nothing meant anything to this guy, just a thoroughly bad egg. He runs up to Alan's wife, and he kneels down and kisses each of the little girls, you know, 4, 6, 8 years old. And then he kisses Mrs. Alan on the cheek and grabs the train as it starts moving out. And when he comes into the coach, he's crying too. Never forget it. Told us he'd spent his embarkation furlough with a hooker somewhere in Winnipeg, and I don't doubt for a minute he did. But I have a real strong, sneaking suspicion that somewhere he had a nice wife and little kids like Alan had. Funny about guys in the Army. You can never tell about them.
I didn't want to go to war. Why should I join up? Get myself killed off by some German guy who didn't want to be in the war either and didn't know me like I didn't know him or vice versa? You get what I mean? Except for one thing. I'm Jewish. And while my old man didn't want me to go to join up, like, you know, why don't I go to the University of Toronto, be a doctor or a lawyer or something, but keep out of the whole business. But my mother, she's a battleship, that woman. She wouldn't hear of it. It's just going to go when his time comes, and when he gets to Jerusalem, he's going to the Western Wall, and he's going to take out his psalm book, and he's going to read the 83rd Psalm. Mom sort of had the war all twisted up in her mind, you know. She'd read the headlines about the British 8th Army fighting near Cairo, and she'd look at a map, and holy smokes, that's only 2 inches from Jerusalem. 2 inches on the map, like maybe 250 miles. One son of hers is going to pray at the wall, you bet your life. So, while the old man is against it, there's Mom practically pushing me out the door on my 18th birthday down to the recruiting station. "Join the army, my boy," she says, "and you'll get there faster. Look, look where they were on the front page of the Star last night, not that far from Jerusalem." It doesn't fit her thinking that the whole idea of the 8th Army is to get far away from Cairo over to the west, as far away from Jerusalem as it can. She was one woman with tunnel vision. I join up. So, A year in Canada, 4 months in England, then France, Germany, and home again. About 2.5 years. Home, and my folks meet me at Union Station. Brothers, sisters, brother-in-law, you know, their kids, cousins. Real big Jewish reunion right in the center of the station. God, when I think of it, Mom gets to me first. And I get hugs and kisses, and everybody is around. And finally she says, "Yes, sir, did you use the book?" I ask, "What book?" "The Book of Psalms I gave you on your last leave." Then it hits me. The Western Wall, Jerusalem, the 122nd Psalm, the 83rd Psalm, standing up there with all those old men crying and weeping, the kind of Jew I just don't like. I tell her, "Mom, I didn't get to Jerusalem. I didn't get anywhere near it. Our army wasn't going that way. We turned right instead of turning left." That was the wrong thing to say, making fun of something like that. She stops me cold with that look in her eyes. And she's a little woman, but solid steel. And she says one word. She says, "Schlepper." Just schlepper. That's what I am. A schlepper. For Mom, I don't fight the war for democracy in Canada. I fight it to go to Jerusalem so she can tell the neighborhood women, Hadassah, Mrs. Moser down the street, and all the rest about her son Isser. The crazy thing is, later when she'd calmed down, I told her I was sorry that my war career hadn't worked out the way she wanted it, and she came up with a beautiful line. She said, "Isser, you just didn't try hard enough."
In the countries that have not suffered invasion, it's hard to realize what the coming of the Nazis would mean. In Winnipeg, they've just held an IF day. IF meaning invasion. The mayor is arrested. The flag of freedom is hauled down to be replaced by the crooked cross. The entire city is at once placed under martial law, and Nazi martial law at that. The freedom of the press, of course, is promptly abolished. Civilians everywhere are roughly handled, kicked out of restaurants, for instance, as all food is commandeered by the invaders. Religious freedom abolished. All places of worship immediately closed. Priests and ministers seized and probably murdered. The new order has no place for religion except when Hitler calls upon the deity for help. Schools would be taken over, for the children of the conquered people are taught quite a different culture. Everything would be Nazified as Hitler has tried to Nazify Europe. All property looted and paid for, perhaps, with worthless paper promises. The leaders and many others beside march to a concentration camp to be starved, ill-treated, and tortured. All this and much more would happen here if...
It was like kids playing cowboys and Indians this IF day. They had it in Winnipeg in 42. I remember there was snow on the ground. The idea of the IF part was, what if German troops occupied Winnipeg? Then what kind of life would we lead? About 3,000 troops took part, and about half, I think, were dressed up like Nazis, and the rest were in Canadian uniform. I think the German duds came from Hollywood, from one of those war movies. That was one part of the IF. The other part was that this here invasion of Winnipeg would go on until a victory bond drive was subscribed. All paid up. V-bond days were big then. Everybody was supposed to buy, and if he didn't, then he was a traitor. I spent any money that would have gone on bonds for booze. I had one kid in Mulvey School, and that's just off Portage Avenue. You know, the main drag? And these guys dressed like monkeys came into his classroom and tore all the patriotic slogans off the walls, yelling and shaking their fists, carrying on like monkeys. Oh sure, the Canadian troops lost. The Germans were supposed to have a division in armored vehicles, and they zoomed up and down Portage Avenue for a while and burned some old books from the public library and captured the Manitoba cabinet and put them somewhere. Can you really imagine people in the middle 20th century giving a damn about such shenanigans? I remember there was a picture in the paper showing the German troops giving a hard time to the newspaper seller at Portage in Maine for selling newspapers, I guess. They tore up his papers. They did some looting, too, carrying some furniture out of a downtown hotel. I mean, what the hell? Why carry furniture out of a building into the snow? It was so dumb a plot that even a fool wouldn't believe the darn thing, and Winnipeg was laughing about it, laughing their heads off. How far was Germany? 6,000 miles, I guess. But maybe that didn't have anything to do with it. I can't remember if they got their war bond money, but I guess they did. They always seem to. Even if they had to put the Prime Minister on the radio and get him to cry his eyes out for the people to give. That was IF Day. And it was a farce.
Nobody questioned anything. It was war, and everything the government did was right. Except, there was one friend of mine. Her family was communist or something like that. Her family used to question the war, how things were done, and I used to report them to the RCMP. And she was my friend. This is the way we lived. I can't remember too clearly, but I remember picking things up around her home, pamphlets, which I thought were absolutely terrible, and that the whole country was going to rack and ruin. Later on, I didn't think anything happened. That was the time when we were friends with the Russians. Allies. But I did report them to the Mounties. It was crazy when you look back on it now, what we did.
Got to England with the 1st Division, it was just about Christmas, and they put us in an old barracks in a place called Woking. That 1939 winter was one of the worst Britain had had in a long time, and the huts had no heating, and being Canadian, heating was one thing we were used to. We had to scrounge wood and coal, and we weren't very good at that because we were just recruits, so all in all, it was a pretty miserable winter. We were at the Inkerman Barracks. The lights were still on in London. They were still selling bananas and oranges in the store, and we were having a great time. The air raid shelters were there, but not used yet. There was no sense of impending doom, but a lot of comradeship. The feeling was the British would fight for a few months, put these people down, and go back to the usual, you know, running the world. At Woking, we got our basic training. Sort of training. Well, we could pick up. They showed us the end of the rifle that the bullet came out of and gave us the red patches. You know, the famous red patches of the Canadian 1st Division. I was in the service corps by then. We didn't get much training in. But we were training with the 7th British Corps and the 51st Highland Division. The infantry was part of it. And so we just fumbled our way through the winter. I think it was late February. The 51st Highland Division went to France. And they were wiped out when the Germans started taking over. I want to say this. We didn't know what was happening. We knew the Germans were going like hell, but we didn't know anything more. Nobody did, I think. So they bundled us up, took us down to the coast, and put us on a ship, and we disembarked at Brest. We had all the food supplies, the petrol supplies, all the ammo, and it was our job to get it up to the front. So there we were, with the Germans maybe only 100 miles ahead, and the whole of France had collapsed, and we were still going on our merry jaunt. I'll say. It was like you're at a football game, when it's over and everyone just surges for the exits, and pushes and shoves, and nobody cares about anyone else. French troops, civilians, old men, women, kids, bicycles, baby carriages, cars pulled by horses or cows, wagons, push carts, all going down the road.
tens of thousands of them. And they didn't know where they were going, except they'd say the Germans were coming. They called them the Bosch. But we didn't have any orders. We just sat there. This was the time of Dunkirk, and then they say to get the hell back to Brest. Get back any way you can. That's when we scattered. Every truck for itself. So my partner and I headed back, and I think the Germans were maybe only a few miles behind, and these refugees, it was tough going past them. Thousands, and they didn't know where they were going. Where were they going? Where's there to go? It was lucky there was no strafing by the Germans where we were. It was chaos. There was no order that I could see, no regimental discipline, nothing, just one vast screw-up, and it lasted like that for some time, as I remember. Anybody could have conquered England if they just could have got ashore. Britain had nothing left to defend itself with. All our prime fighting forces, and when they got back after Dunkirk, it was just a great mass of men. No material, no guns, no ammunition, no organization, no nothing at all.
Vor dem großen Tor stand eine Laterne und steht sie noch davor. So wollen wir uns da wiedersehen. Bei der Laterne wollen wir stehen, wie einst die liebe Marlene, wie einst die liebe Marlene.
The Big Raid, they called it. I remember my sister sent me a clipping from some paper, a headline, and it was the day they released the news, and it said that Canadian troops were jubilant about the success of their invasion of France. Now that is pure and unadulterated bullshit. We got the shit kicked out of us. It was about 10 hours of unadulterated hell, from the moment the Germans saw us coming in our dinky little boats until we got off. We were trying to scale the cliffs the size of the Royal York Hotel, and the Germans had us crisscrossed six ways from Sunday, and it was, well, I guess you could call it a massacre. It sure wasn't our victory, or even a saw-off. It was a German victory all the way. Maybe if we'd had gunnery support from the Royal Navy before hitting the beaches, maybe that would be different. But in the end, it would not have made one sweet continental dam. We were just ducks in a shooting gallery. Look at the casualties. Worse per unit, I think, than any time else in the war. Whole companies wiped out and captured just like that. Zoop! In fact, the casualties were so bad they dribbled them out to the newspapers 100 or 200 at a time. And it was weeks before they said how many wounded, killed in action, died of wounds, missing, and of course captured. The Germans filled up a prison camp with our guys after that one. But I'll tell you one thing, and I think most people don't know this. Dieppe had one effect. It taught them swollen-assed generals something. Some genius in the British War Office likely said, "I say, old chap, how do we know the Germans are actually there? Might have a raid, you know? A jolly big one. See if they are there, what they've got, right?" And Churchill or somebody probably said, "Oh, jolly good thinking. Brothering hot, and we'll send it to the Canadians. See if the beggars are as good as they say they are." Well, we were good, but not even King Kong and all his friends from the jungle and John Wayne could have done anything there. It was like telling you to go up to the main post office over on Front Street and start hitting one of those big pillars at the entrance with your fist, and keep hitting until you knock it down. All you get is blood and broken bones.
Dieppe, I think it was a shambles. But in retrospect, I think it had its merits too.
I was involved with the I section, intelligence at that time, and I've always maintained that it was bad planning from our point of view. But the raid went on, for two reasons. One, this raid was done to encourage the Russians, and also to show the world, but especially the Canadian people, that their troops were at the ready and eager for battle. That's number one. But the aspect to which I was privy, and I've never seen anything written about this, was that on the 19th of August, the day of the Dieppe raid, the largest convoy up to that time to leave England would pass the mouth of the Channel. It was a 200-ship convoy to North Africa, loaded with troops and equipment to do the final roll-up of General Rommel's forces in Africa. Now, one thing is significant here. The Dieppe raid was to have been in mid-July. It had been scheduled for that time. There was no other reason to change the date to August, the day of the other sailing. So, in my opinion, the Dieppe raid had the effect of occupying the attention of the German Navy, the German Air Force, and, obviously, the land forces. It stopped them from interfering with the passage of that convoy until it was out of those dangerous waters and on to comparative safety. So, if you want to call Dieppe a sacrifice, then it was a sacrifice. But in retrospect, it was a worthwhile sacrifice, in terms of helping to protect that huge convoy which was heading for North Africa.
Overseas in July of 42, I think. Just a bunch of Air Force guys in a troop ship loaded with Army guys. Anyway, on the dock, there was a few women, and they had baskets, and they were passing out apples, little bags of things like hard candy, razor blades, maybe an orange, knitted socks, all those kinds of things. They were just ladies of the town of Halifax. And somebody said they weren't really supposed to be there, but nobody actually turned them away. They'd say, "Good luck, soldier," or "Cheerio, airman." And one lady said to me, "Be sure to write your mother." I always remembered that because I wasn't much of a letter writer. Okay, it's 3 years later, November 1945, another troop ship homeward bound. We come off the gangplank, and there's ambulances for some of the guys who need them, but mostly it's just us, thinner, maybe a bit wiser. And I'll be damned if there isn't this same old lady. And she says as we pass by, she says as she hands me an orange and the Halifax paper, "Did you write your mother, son?" And I nearly dropped dead. I think, does she remember me? No, because I hear her say the same thing to a guy about two places behind me in line. And you know what? That old biddy must have been doing that job, rain or shine, passing out little goodies and asking the guys if they would please write to their mothers. One hell of an old gal, year after year after year. Somebody should have pinned a medal on one of those old gals. Maybe someone did.
Boys in Europe thought they had a long flight if they had 7 or 8 hours, but for us, 14 hours was a pretty routine mission. We were flying Liberator bombers, American-made, and we would hit Rangoon, Siam, Malaya, Burma, and once we even did a raid dropping pamphlets on Singapore. There's not too much heavy anti-aircraft by then. The Japs were pretty well finished, but we used to blow up a few troop concentrations with fragmentation bombs. See, the Japanese had pretty well had it. Gin and lime cordial was the big drink then. We'd fill up our flasks with booze, and on the long flights, when we came back, we'd be smashed. Yeah, I think there was an agreement that either the pilot or the co-pilot would stay reasonably sober, get us down all right. Yeah, when you're 19, it was still a pretty exciting war.
Yeah.
One thing about the whole evacuation of Japanese from Western Canada, it wasn't just war. It was part economic. They used the war as an excuse. For example, the other fishermen were more than happy to see the Japanese go, and so were the politicians. Whoever cried, "Out with the Japs!" they got the vote. And so there was no holding back saying the Japanese were good fishermen, and we gotta keep them here because fish is good and we need food for the war effort. There was none of that. Get them out of here. And of course, it was the white fishermen who got the Japanese boats and the gear and houses. In the Fraser Valley, I would say the majority of the other farmers were more than pleased to see the Japanese go, so they could pick up their farms afterwards. This is what happened, and this is something that's not said very often.
I think we started deliveries at 4 p.m., and most or many of our telegrams would be killed in action, wounded, or missing in action. As I remember, there were a lot of missing in action, because this was fairly early in the war, and most of the guys getting it were in bombers and fighters, you know, the RCAF and the RAF. We'd get our sheaf of telegrams, you see. They had to be delivered at night because there would usually be somebody home. Maybe out of 30 telegrams, 5 might be casualties. Sometimes as many as 8 or 10, but that was pretty high. Sometimes if we weren't sure, we could sneak open the edge of the slicked down envelope, and if we saw it was a casualty telegram, then we'd go next door and get a woman there to come with us. Not to bolster up our courage, this was old hat with us, but when a woman just finds out her husband has been shot down and killed, she shouldn't be left alone. I always remember those telegrams. They'd start out with something like this: "The Department of National Defense regret." Well, that's all we needed to know. Zoom. Next door and get a neighbor. I always wondered why it shouldn't be the word regrets instead of regret. Isn't regrets better grammar? I guess we were such a callous bunch of young buggers, we didn't really think we were smashing some woman's life to bits. We were interested only because a word didn't sound right. If neighbors saw a telegraph boy going up to a house, they'd usually know. Not all that many people had phones then, the Depression being what it was. But there were 2 mails a day and 1 on Saturday. And sometimes you'd be in a house, and before you'd left, there'd be a couple of neighbor women heading for the house. This would be in the slums, the poorer districts, where people looked after each other better, not the richer parts, the poorer ones. I always hung around a couple of minutes just to see if they were all right. I'd always ask if there was something I could do. A few times I made tea for women, or I'd run to the nearest phone and call the husband or the daughter or something. I think it must have been the telegraph company that told us not to leave them alone. Jesus Christ, when I think of it, what a rotten way to do things. Sending a young punk of a kid on a bike riding down a street so everybody can see him and everybody wondering, is he stopping here or where will he stop? But you got to remember that later on, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of those things delivered. My own mother got one when I got captured. She said it wasn't so bad. I said, "What do you mean it wasn't so bad?" She said she didn't mean it that way, but by that time, and this was in August of 44, the sight of the telegraph boy was a pretty common sight, with his black bag and his sheaf of yellow telegrams. And after all, the Carpenter kids and the Melnick kid and the Hudson kid, all within a stone's throw, they'd all got it by then, and they were just around the block. Remember when Lorne Greene, the guy who became Pa Cartwright on Bonanza? He was on the 9 o'clock news, and he was called the voice of doom. That big voice giving us the war news every night. And a lot of it was doom. Well, I guess us kids, 16 or 17-year-olds, kids on our rallies and CCMs, we were the riders of doom, although I never thought about it that way. But I'll bet you a lot of women and men who got those telegrams thought of it that way. I guess I was taking part in just about the toughest job of war work and didn't even know about it. Yes, yes, I guess so. Riders of Doom.
Carry on, Canada! The inexorable march of the days brings this country near the close of the second year of war. A transformed Canada, many of her men and women clad in uniform, all her people growing more and more conscious of the dangers to this continent of Nazi victory in Europe, faces the unknown future with courage in her heart and increasing understanding in her mind. More and more definitely, the attention of the Canadian people is drawn to the true peril in which they stand. And more definitely, burns the flame of our determination to face those dangers and to bear a noble part in bringing them to naught. Serious of purpose, strong in resolution, Canada carries on.
All pulled together through the stormy weather. Carry on, carry on, carry on. Keep on trying, keep the old flag flying. Carry on, carry on, carry on. The sun is shining above the cloudy sky. A silver lining will greet you by and by. So all pulled together through the stormy weather. Carry on, carry on, carry on.
Actually hear the V-1s coming overhead. Their primitive jet engine pulsed away until it had gone a predetermined distance when a ton of high explosives plunged into the target below. We call them buzz bombs or doodle bugs, but the V-2 rockets were more like today's guided missiles. They came down out of the stratosphere faster than sound without warning. That's what made them an unprecedented weapon of such terror. Just imagine knowing that at any time, day or night, you could be wiped off the map or maimed forever by a deadly rocket you never heard coming. That's terror in my books. I was based in London during the war. There was a little Cockney secretary in the office I was kind of fond of. One morning in 1944, she called to say she couldn't come in that day. Why not? Our house was destroyed last night. Oh, sorry, my dear. Look after your mom until she gets settled again. Can't. Oh, why? Because she was killed by the bomb. Oh. Sorry. See what I mean? Still, the Brits held out until Germany surrendered, but I'll tell you this. If the Blitz attacks had gone on another few months, it's very likely London would have been finished.
And love in my heart, all for you.
We'll be right back.
daughter is in women's liberation. When I was just about her age, there was nothing like that. There'd been a lot of talk about emancipation, you know, years before, but that was women getting the vote, wasn't it? But no women's liberation. Looking back on it, we had a pretty poor time of it. That's what the war did, though. Got thousands, oh my goodness, tens of thousands of women and girls out of the home. In 1936, I came to Winnipeg from Dauphin, just out of high school. There were three things you could do. You could work as a waitress and have some fry cook pawing you. I know, I tried that for 2 weeks. You could work at Eaton's department store mail order for $11 to $12 a week and walk out of there half dead every night to a lonely room somewhere. I had friends who did that, and that was enough for me. Or you could go work for a family. Of course, that meant that you were cook, bottle washer, ran errands, washed floors, and you were the babysitter, but you know, back home in Dauphin, that's what I was doing anyway. I got in through a friend of a friend with a nice family named Gilbert, in a nice house, and I had a room in the basement, a bathroom with shower, and I got Thursday afternoons and Sunday afternoons off after the noon dinner. The pay was only $14 a month, but all in all, that wasn't bad. I was probably better off than those poor girls at Eaton's or some insurance company office because my bed and food was paid for. And that went on until 1940. In 1940, there were war plants starting up. And I went to Toronto because there was an airman stationed at Trenton that I was gaga about. But that didn't work out. But it sure got me out of Winnipeg. And I've never been back except passing through. It was good to be there when I was there. But when my girlfriend and me landed in Toronto, well, you could say we were in a different world. Toronto was a big city, and Winnipeg was just a widening of the road on the prairies. In the radio plant we both worked at, there were hundreds of women. All the bosses were men, but we expected that. Today they'd be demanding women bosses, but not then. Hundreds of women from all over Canada. I've stood at the same workbench with women who had hired girls just like me as domestics. You know, at $5 a week. And now they were complaining they couldn't get maids of their own to work 14 hours a day, cooking and washing and doing their dirty work because they had all gone into war plants at $25 or $30 a week for a nine-hour day. Oh, you'd have thought we were all traitors. I asked one why she was working in a plant, and she said that her husband was an officer in the Air Force overseas, and she just didn't have much to do. So she was working in the plant, next to domestics like me. Funny. I guess you'd call me a stepper. That's a person who steps out. You never hear it now. Means a girl who likes a good time. Likes to go out dancing and partying a lot, and not with one fellow, but with lots of fellows. Well, I sure stepped out in Toronto. I learned what this old world is all about, and I had a good time during the war. And I made good money, and because I always had dates, I saved some money. After what I had spent for clothing and lipsticks and stockings when I could get them. And our pay kept getting better and better. The war killed all the servant business, being a maid. And I think it did a lot to finish off the idea that a woman's place is in the home. My God, there were tens of thousands of us living a life, the kind of life that we'd never known before. Money and good times and lots of men, and more than anything, I guess you could say, freedom. Yes, I'll admit some just couldn't handle the freedom, but they were just a few. Husbands and boyfriends came back from the war and found their wives and girlfriends just weren't prepared to start washing dishes again. Must have been quite a shock. But some women had ferried Air Force bombers to Britain and others drove ambulances and worked in canteens serving the troops, or in war plants, handling very expensive tools, working on equipment, planes, instrument panels and things. And the companies found they could do all this better than men. It's no lie.
Coast to coast, the Dominion celebrates the long-awaited day of victory in the West. In every town in the Dominion, the strain of over 5 years of war is relaxed momentarily as Canucks pay tribute to their sons who have played such a vital part in winning victory in the West.
I'll never forget VE Day. It was the most vivid thing. We were in stuffy old Victoria. We were just kids. We wore skirts and sweaters and bobby socks. Just kids. The whole place went crazy. You wouldn't believe it. We heard about it and everybody in our school cut classes. Even the teachers cut classes. And it was just kissing and hugging and screaming. Bands and parades and people just going up and down the streets. Just absolutely mad. There was no such thing as time or not knowing somebody. You hugged everybody you met and sang at the top of your lungs. There were sailors and soldiers with bottles of rum, and men from the shipyards with cases of beer, and just everybody was drinking everywhere, and fellows climbing lampposts and going through the downtown streets singing and laughing. Nobody was throwing things or breaking anything, and the police just stood by and let people have a good time. And they had the band playing Roll Out the Barrel and other war songs, and this must have gone on for hours, but nobody got tired, not that I know of. And people were singing and shouting as loud as when the first whistles blew until it got dark that night. My girlfriends and me, we were about 13 or 14, and I don't really think we knew there was a war on, except for the blackout curtains, and because we didn't have the kinds of clothes we wanted. And some of our older brothers had gone to the war. But we just went crazy as anybody that day and got kind of hysterical and whooped it up as if we'd just won the war by ourselves.
We were prisoners working in a Japanese copper mine. We had a radio in the camp, and the day the emperor told his people they had gone under, we immediately took over the camp. And we ran ourselves. The head of our camp was an American officer, Captain Ziegler from Wichita Falls, Texas, and he just took over. He told the Japanese, "You people just stay there. The war's over. Come and we'll show you how we know." And he took out a radio. I still have the earphones, and this radio was put together out of odds and ends, bits and pieces, and it worked beautifully. I worked in a battery shop, and as prisoners, it was rather a dangerous thing to bring out batteries for a radio. I once carried a small wet cell battery under my hat, and I didn't dare stumble or anything, because the acid would have run down my head, but it was the only way that we could get them into camp. We became the conquerors, and they became the prisoners, so to speak, even though we were all still in the camp. Within a couple of days, planes off of an aircraft carrier came and asked us to lay out a signal of what we needed, food, medical supplies, and they started dropping big boxes of stuff. We gained weight quickly, but because we weren't used to the food, a lot of people were sick. The Americans came in a month after the surrender, about September 19th, and they took us and put us on a hospital ship and gave us a shower, a spray, and took all the new clothes they had dropped by plane and just shoveled them overboard and gave us new uniforms. That was funny. You know, we had decided that when we marched out of that camp, we'd wear our new uniforms. So we wore our old clothes, the ones we'd been in for years, for the whole of that last month. And then when we got aboard the hospital ship, they took away those uniforms. So here they were, throwing away uniforms that had only been worn a few hours. After going 4 years without clothes, it was a shattering experience. another funny thing happened in Guam, in the hospital. We were putting these Quonset huts, all made up neat with bunks and pajamas, and our boys all got in bed, and they turned out the lights, and then you'd hear thump, and thump, and thump. And the lights went on, and the nurses and orderlies came in, and we were all laying on the floor. Soft beds? We couldn't sleep in them. So after about three times, they just told us to sleep where we liked. The next morning, the Red Cross people came in. There were girls who tried to get us to talk to them, write letters, home, and so on. It took us about a day to get used to it. We hadn't seen women for so long, we couldn't talk to them. We didn't even know how to act with them around.
Boys are home again, all over the world. And rain or snow is all that may fall from the skies above. A kiss won't mean goodbye, but hello to love. Lights go on again all over the world, and the ships will sail again all over the world. Then we'll have time for things like wedding rings and free hearts. When the lights go on again, all over the world.
All in all, when you take everything into the overall plan, faint now of every consideration, I guess you could really, really say the enemy lost the last war. Because they had lousier leaders than we did. If you thought there was unbelievable pig-headed thinking on our side, there must have been even more on the other side. Stands to reason. I don't know who said it, but war is far, far too important to leave to the politicians and the generals. And I still believe that.
When the lights go on again, all over the world, and the ships will sail again, all over the world, then we'll have time for things like wedding rings and free hearts will sing. When the lights go on again, all over the world.
On the Eclectic Lunch today, we heard the voices of Seth Little, Keenan Johnston, Paul Herbert, Adam Abrams, Sean Harris Oliver, Tracy Varju, John Prowse, Ashley O'Connell, Jessica Wright, John R. Taylor, Sebastian Kroon, Mary Black, Maureen Rode, Tarek Leslie, and Jason Logan, with music by Spike Jones, Vera Lynn, and many others. Our theme music is by Ry Cooter, and this little ditty is by the great Neil Hefti. If there's something you'd like to hear on Eclectic Lunch, drop us a line at daveradiopodcast@hotmail.com. You can search out our podcast archive at citr.ca. And remember to like, share, and subscribe, because Sharon deserves it. Keep your dial set on CITR all afternoon. Up next is Chopped and Screwed, a show for all things sampling. That's followed at 2 by Radio Art from Beppe Crespin. And as he's always been since 1987, our very own star on the BC Entertainment Walk of Fame, Nardwuar the Human Serviette, at 3:30. We'll be back with more delightful morsels on the Eclectic Lunch next week at this same time. We now return you to regular programming.
Listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
CM,